The following presentation was recorded at the 2000 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Albert Einstein couldn't talk until he was 4 years old and couldn't read until he was 7. He was described by his teacher as mentally slow, unsociable, and adrift forever in his foolish dreams. He was later expelled from the Zurich Polytechnic School, and when he reapplied for admittance, he was refused. When Peter J. Daniel was a fourth grader, Mrs. Phillips, who happened to be his teacher, told him often, "Peter, you're no good. You're a bad apple, and you're never going to amount to anything." Peter never did learn to read or write until he was 26 years old. What made a change? A friend stayed with him and read to him the book, Think and Grow Rich. Today, he owns many of the street corners that he used to fight on and authored his book, Mrs. Phillips, You Were Wrong. Beethoven was not very good on the violin because he preferred playing his own compositions rather than working to improve his techniques. His teacher said, "You are hopeless as a composer." Louis Pasteur was just a very mediocre student in his undergrad studies. Later, he ranked 15th out of 22 students in his chemistry major. Babe Ruth is considered by many sports authorities and historians to be one of the greatest athletes of all time. Of course, he is best known for his hitting the most home runs in a season. But did you know he also holds the record for the most strikeouts? The noted sculptor Rodin had a father who said, "I have an idiot for a son." Rodin attempted 3 times to gain admittance to an art school. He had been described by a teacher as the worst pupil in this school. Leo Tolstoy, who later wrote War and Peace, flunked out of college. They described him as both unable and unwilling to learn. Surprise, surprise. We just never really know about people. As teachers, we must be very careful not to tag, categorize, finalize, or write some people off prematurely. It's easy to be wrong when, with some encouragement, we might be teaching a future president, missionary, or minister. I'd just like to know, how many of you have taught at least 1 year? Raise your hands. Okay, great. And how many of you had at least one student that struggled academically? It's not surprising. If any of you will be in a classroom for any length of time, you're going to encounter that. And have you thought and wondered what it would be like to have a classroom that doesn't have any student with a learning disability? The places you could go? I don't think so. Think about how boring it might be as well. In 1993, I had a girl come into my 5th grade classroom who had really struggled a lot academically through her elementary years. Not only had she been labeled as being slow, but she was also profoundly dyslexic. Her eyes held no sparkle. I don't know if you've ever observed, but whenever students really struggle a lot, there's just kind of a dullness that you see in their eyes. They're just discouraged, and there's just a darkness that seems to prevail. And that's the countenance that she had. She had repeated first grade, and her school experience of 5 years had just been failure, failure, failure. I had her teachers tell me that, "We know Carrie could do it if she just tried. If she just really put herself to it, she could do it." Well, unknown to us at that time, and it wasn't until she was, I believe, in fourth grade that we had some testing done, and there were other factors that came into play other than motivation. So when she came into my 5th grade classroom, it was a challenge to even try to decipher her writing. Her reading was haltingly slow. She had limited comprehension and vocabulary when reading. Just to give you an idea of her writing ability, when she came into fifth grade, this was her first journal entry, and I have my students write quite a few journals. She had, let me get another paper here. I'm not sure if she had how much skill she had in writing cursive. So she started out by printing, and just read down through it and see if you can decipher what she's writing here. I'll read it for you. Yesterday, I came into the room. I was glad to come. I was not afraid because I wanted to see my friends. I really could not wait. The day was fast, and we had a fun day together. And one thing, it was hot. Now, just her sentence composition would indicate that this would be a third grade level, maybe even second grade. A second grader could do it if it's a high achiever. But she's in fifth grade and actually has had, would have been her sixth year of school. And she's writing like this. We kept writing almost daily. And in a few months, you could already tell a noticeable difference. She's turning to cursive and her ideas are flowing a little bit better. But she still has problems with punctuation and spelling. And this is what she wrote in January. The year of 1994, with God's help, I would like to improve the following areas of my life. At home, I would like to improve obeying my mother and coming right away when mom calls me and clean without grumbling for working. At school, I would like to be a better friend to everyone, be kind and help someone who is struggling. Isn't that precious? At church, invite people over who haven't been to my house. Being nice to other friends that aren't nice. Listen to the preacher more often. Well, where do you begin with a student like her? I believe a key factor, and if there's anything you walk away with today, I want you to remember this. A key factor in helping a struggling student is to give them affirmation and encouragement. They have been defeated so many times, they just need a large dose of encouragement. Affirmation, you can do it, I'm with you, I'm going to stick with you, we can do this together. And for her in particular, I needed to create an environment where she felt accepted and wasn't threatened by expectations. Up to that point, she was expected to do everything anyone else was expected to do. If the rest of the class had 20 spelling words, she was expected to do 20 spelling words. If the rest of the class read orally, she was expected to do that. And so I talked to her at the beginning about her problem. It wasn't a secret anymore. The class knew, I knew, her teachers had known, and she knew. And I told her that I don't want to embarrass her in any way. And if she doesn't feel comfortable in reading orally when I call on students, that's okay. She doesn't have to. And there seemed to be just a great relief. But it was interesting. As she began gaining confidence, guess what happened? She started getting involved in the classroom activities as well because she felt like it was safe. Well, we decided to put her on a tutoring program early on that year, and we asked one of our high school students to work with her on a regular basis. This high school student worked with her approximately an hour and a half each day for 2 years. It kind of reminded me of a Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan situation, and the two really bonded. We use the Stevenson Reading Program and the Simple Math Program, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. Anyway, by the end of sixth grade, I called on her one day to read orally, and by that time she was responding, she didn't mind. And all of a sudden, I realized with a start, she was just reading fluently, and it struck me that day, this girl is reading. It was just a yes day for Carrie and me, and I mentioned something. I could just tell she felt so good about herself. Well, did this solve all her problems being on a tutoring program? No. Carrie still has struggles with schoolwork and with academics. And in fact, at this point, she's not been able to work at her grade level. It's just not been attainable. But I am delighted to tell you that this fall she'll be a senior. She hasn't given up. She's persisted. And I do hope to attend her graduation next spring. And I tell you this story because I want you to remember that all children have a potential to learn. They can learn, but it's going to take commitment from the moms and dads, from teachers, from the student himself. It'll take hard work, dedication. And if you teach, like I said earlier on, if you teach at any length of time, you're going to get students almost every year that are wrapped up in these special needs packages. But you may be that person that will make the difference in a child's life. And the earlier on you can begin working with these students, starting in first grade, the more successful will be their life and school experiences. However, change can come anytime in one's life, as is the story of John Corcoran. He wrote the book, The Teacher Who Couldn't Read. I would highly recommend this as a biography. It's an incredible story of a man that hid his problem for 48 years. And this past winter, I was able to attend an evening listening to him speak as he told his story of his learning disability. And again, unknown to his family and his teachers, he had a problem with auditory processing, having to do with the way he heard things, and phonological processing facets. And he basically went through school not knowing how to read. In fact, he claims that he didn't know the alphabet until he was 12 years old. And I know the question you have, how in the world did a teacher catch on by that time? Well, his family had moved around quite a bit. In his 16 years of school, I believe they had, or 12 years of school, they had moved 17 different places. And so he was just at one place long enough to kind of know there's a problem here, but not long enough to work through that problem. He ended up graduating from high school, went on to the university, and became a high school teacher, still not being able to read. He says, and I'm going to read his words, he says, yes, I am a graduate of a university with a bachelor's degree in education and business administration. I have completed over 90 additional graduate hours in education, economics, and sociology at more than four major universities. I have experienced a continuing education in my professional careers as a developer, builder, and educator. I attended school for 35 years. Half of those years, I was a professional educator. It may be incredibly shocking to some, but it is indisputable that in acquiring these experiences, I could not read a textbook or write the answer to an essay question. Well, through a series of events, John became really desperate to learn how to read, and at the age of 48, he learned. So I'm pointing this out that really no matter where you are in life, it is possible to learn. And in his book, he describes how he faced this problem and how he learned to read successfully. Learning disabilities is really a broad subject, and one can hardly do justice to it in 75 minutes. So I've narrowed it down to giving you a background of learning disabilities and showing you the definition and also the characteristics that accompany a learning disabled student. And then I'd like to provide an overview of assessments you can do and programs for a learning disabled child. And then suggest ways on how to work with a student that has learning disabilities in our small schools. Because you see, I know where you are. You are limited with staff and funds. So how in the world do we help someone that is struggling? Earlier on, I asked if you've had a student that struggled academically, and I'd like to suggest that there actually are three categories. when you think about students that are struggling, you have over here on this side the average child. And probably there really is nothing like the average child. But for a term of reference, they probably will score on their IQs between 90 and 105. So they're usually on the lower half of the academic achievement level. They are the students that need lots of drill and encouragement. And motivation is going to be a big factor because they have to work so hard and so long. It's not that they don't know it, but it's just they have to put forth that extra effort. Where when you have those high achievers, they can look at something once and know the answer. And so they become discouraged. And I think to help these students, you just need to pour on that encouragement. Then we have another category called the slow student. Now, academically, they really have a problem functioning. It's very borderline. They find it difficult to work independently, because their IQ scores range between 70 and, it says 80, but it should be 85. So you know right from the start, if you do any testing at all, that yes, academics will probably be a struggle. And sometimes it's difficult to differentiate to whether they're just slow or coming from a disadvantaged background. Because let's say that you have a student that comes up from Mexico and enters the States, and he's in a classroom where you have people that are speaking English and all he knows is Spanish. So at that point, he's disadvantaged. Maybe with time he'll catch up. That's giving a really clear definition. Some are less obvious, but their experience before they came to school was limited, and therefore they can't do as well. A slow student is not necessarily slow in all of his activities or abilities. He may just do very well when it comes to kinesthetic activities, or socially he or she may do very well. But they will struggle with materials at their grade level. And abstract concepts are a total frustration. They need the concrete approach. So when you can take actual demonstrations in front of the classroom and get them involved with their body or with their hands, that's where they learn best. They have a short attention span, and so learning tasks need to be, especially for younger ones, need to be broken down in bits and chunks. And then practice, practice, practice. And for them, once they have it, they usually will have it. It's not that they'll lose it. It just takes them much longer to gain. And they tend not to be flexible. They resist change. And then we have the student that is struggling that would be classified as a student with learning disabilities. They have average or above average intelligence, and very often above average. They just don't think the same way that most of the teachers do. And so to zero in on their style of learning, or to understand what's working in their mind, is a challenge for the teacher. Sometimes there just really is no logical explanation for the difficulty, but there's an apparent breakdown in process or application of the concept. Somehow they just cannot, what they are hearing or seeing is not connecting with their brain. There's been a lot of brain research going on in the last 15 years. If you do any reading of that sort, you understand how fearfully and wonderfully we're made. And it's no wonder that sometimes we're just at a loss to know what to do next, because really our brain is quite complex and has, it just doesn't always provide the answers that we need. The term learning disabilities was first coined in 1963. There were a group of concerned parents and educators that met together for a meeting one weekend. And their idea was to link a few straggling communities here and there, link them together, and make one single organization. Well, each parent that attended this meeting had a student in school that was struggling in some area, and each of them were identified under a different name. So they decided that if they're going to become one organization, they really need to agree on a single term for these different students. And they decided, or Samuel Kirk was in that meeting, and he suggested learning disabilities. And everyone decided that really is a good term. However, they found that when they wanted to put a definition to the term, that was much more difficult than coming up with the term. Someone since has said about the term learning disabilities, said, it is impossible to define, but you know it when you see it. And I know that you as teachers know what I mean by that. The most widely used definition, and there are several, but the most widely used is the one recognized in the public law, 94-142, or Education of All Handicapped Children Act in 1975. If you do any reading in learning disabilities, you'll come across that time and time again. And this law states that all handicapped children and youth from ages 3 to 21 have a legal right to a free and appropriate education in the least restrictive environment. Just show you what the definition looks like. Now remember, learning disabilities is a cluster of disorders, and no one individual will encompass all disorders. For example, one person, or let's say we have a student that is struggling in math but is not in reading, or vice versa, will struggle with reading but not in math. Certain kinds of characteristics are more likely to be exhibited than at other ages. So, for example, hyperactivity will be seen more frequently in younger children, but older children won't act out as much as what the younger ones will. The definition for learning disabilities is a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes involved in understanding or in using language spoken or written, which may manifest itself in an imperfect ability to listen, think, speak, read, write, spell, or do mathematical calculations. The term includes such conditions as perceptual handicaps, brain injury, minimal brain dysfunction, dyslexia, and developmental aphasia, a total or partial loss of the power to use or understand words. The term does not include children who have learning problems, which are primarily the result of visual, hearing, or motor handicaps of mental retardation, emotional disturbance, or environmental, cultural, or economic disadvantage. So that's quite the definition. If you would take all the definitions and put them together, there are some themes that come out of it. And one of it is that all of them mention some kind of a neurological dysfunction. So apparently, learning disabilities are actually related to atypical brain function. And the cause could be somewhere in the central nervous system. Often it's difficult to determine because you can't just take them to the doctor and run an x-ray on their brain and decide what's wrong with them. That would solve a lot of our problems if we could just get medication. But that doesn't necessarily answer our problem. And it seems like we teachers are more concerned about behavioral and educational aspects than we are about the medical contributions that may play a part. And I want to talk about that a little bit later on. You will also see in these definitions that they allude to the fact that there are uneven growth patterns. There are certain components of the mental development which will develop at a certain rate and other factors lag behind. For example, a student may be able to reason very well, but has a very difficult time retaining. Retention is a problem. It's not maturing to the level that his reasoning is. The definitions also suggest that there will be difficulty in academic and learning tasks. For example, let's say someone has a problem with listening. Well, that's going to affect decoding, spelling, writing, and following directions. And we also have this discrepancy between potential achievement and or the potential and the actual achievement of the student. So somehow we have to identify the gap. Okay, what can the student actually potentially be capable of doing, and what has he learned or achieved? And some of the ways we can do that is testing. Now again, you could take an IQ test, and many critics will say that they are racially and culturally biased and they really do not tell what a student knows, but they might give us some direction. You might also want to discover the individual's achievement level. You might ask, well, what is his achievement level? And you can do that with standardized tests. And you might need to ask, so what degree of discrepancy is there between the potential and achievement? Is it a severe discrepancy? If you would have a student in first grade, or let's say second grade, and there would be a one-year discrepancy, that would be much more severe than a student with a one-year discrepancy in 11th grade. Do you see the difference? So what are the characteristics that define learning disabilities? Now, you don't need to copy these down. I have that in your handout that I'll be giving to you at the end of the workshop here. So I'll just kind of fly through these. Disorders of attention, you're going to see hyperactivity, distractibility, poor concentration ability, and short attention span. Failure to develop and mobilize cognitive strategies for learning. Lack of organization, that's a big one. You'll see that almost immediately. Failure to facilitate metacognitive functions. Poor motor abilities. Poor fine and gross motor coordination. When I talk about fine, I'm talking about holding the pencil and doing things like cutting paper, anything that would just be using the hands. General awkwardness and clumsiness and spatial problems. They just don't have a sense of direction. They also will struggle with perceptual and information processing. They will have a difficulty in discrimination of auditory and visual stimuli, auditory and visual closure, and sequencing. And this is especially big with a dyslexic person. They just cannot close words or letters or pictures the way you do. And other language difficulties, problems in listening, speaking, vocabulary, struggle with linguistic competencies. I have another list I'm going to go through. They have reading difficulties, problems in decoding, struggle with basic reading skills, reading comprehension is low, written language difficulties, problems in spelling, illegible handwriting, unorganized and illegible written compositions. They can't make their thoughts flow. They have mathematical difficulties, difficulty in quantitative thinking, arithmetic basic concepts, time, space, calculation facts. And then often this is also seen, inappropriate social problems, problems in social perception, emotional behavior, and establishing social relationships. Now, does one student encompass all of these? No. But these are things that you'll see. I also have in the handout, I'll have a checklist that you can go through, and if you have a student that you think has learning disabilities, go through that checklist and write down S on the blank if it's sometimes, or if you see it often, and put an O down for often, And as you look over your paper, you can zero in where the actual problem is. So the first step in beginning to help a student with learning disabilities is starting with assessments. And what I mean is simply just testing. It's the process of collecting information about a student that will be used in forming judgments and making decisions concerning that student. In the public schools, they have what they call the assessment teaching process, and I'm going to go through that hoping that you'll get some ideas on the steps you could take, very similar steps, but they will have more of a problem, or they have to be more careful because there's so many legal things involved. But I do think they have some good ideas on the steps you could take to work with students that have a learning disability. One thing that is really important, always involve your parents, and also document everything, especially if you have students that are coming to your school that aren't from your church, just for legal purposes. Again, you never know. You hope you can trust all people, and yet sometimes schools have been caught in that. So we begin with, the first step is just simply the classroom teacher. You notice within the first week or two, you probably can pick out the student that is going to be struggling that year. In fact, I talked to our first grade teacher, Patty, back there, and she just mentioned that even when she gives the readiness test in the spring, she can usually just kind of zero in and know what student she'll have to work with a little bit more. And that is a good clue to give a readiness test and see if they're ready for first grade. And or do they need more help? So let's say you have a student that has a learning disability. Ask your co-teachers, ask your principal, or anybody who's had some experience. Ask them for ideas of things you could do to help this student. Then go into your classroom and give it a try. All right, this is a pre-referral activity. So you've tried it, you've given it your best shot, still hasn't made any change. So the next thing you would do, and this is, again, remember, this is the step that the public schools would take, but I think it's a good step to take. Now she would refer this student for some more testing. And at this point, or parents could, they could say, look, we see you've been working, but we're not seeing a lot of change here. Could you just please do some testing with him? But before they do that, they have to have it in written permission from parents that we agree to this testing. Now, in our particular school in Indiana, we have been so privileged to be able to be connected with a Christian school in Fort Wayne. And we have taken some of our students down there for testing. And there's a fee that goes with it, but our school has been so gracious in providing funds for that. And we've been able to help some of our students, and it's given us an idea how to work with them. We understand what some of their problems are. And so maybe in your area, if you do a little bit of checking around, you could go to a Christian school that would just be willing to work with you, because some of these teachers have been trained and do have license to do testing. Not just anyone can do these certain tests. There might be some physical aspect. Maybe you might need to check with a doctor or a speech teacher or a reading specialist or any of that sort, and see, check your yellow pages and see if there aren't some available resources you can use for your school. It really becomes a team effort. So then we bring all of this together, and at that point you call for a case meeting. I'm sorry, I kind of skipped number three here. I talked about it, but I didn't move it down. We have the case conference meeting, and you'll see the IEP, which stands for Individualized Education Program. And in the public schools, they insist that a representative of the public school agency has to come in and be in attendance. It has to be some specialist, like a reading specialist or somebody in learning disabilities. The student's teacher one or both parents and the student if it's appropriate. So you have your own little case conferences. You call your parents in. Pull in a teacher from the next room over if she has some insight, or your principal, and discuss what you can do for your student. The case conference will also include a statement of the student's present level performance and the annual goals, and a statement of what services will be provided, and the projected dates for when this will begin and how long they'll stay with it. And then they'll implement this and the teaching begins. It might be a pull-out program where the student has to be tutored or go into some special training of some kind. And then you monitor the student's progress. And again, in the public schools, they're required to review this IEP annually and then reevaluate the student's progress. And it's kind of like they start all over again, and maybe they have to do more testing, or maybe they are satisfied, they're making progress, and they just keep improving the expectations for the student. The big question is, how do we work with learning disabilities in our small Mennonite schools? I'd like to suggest you begin early. Some children are at risk for LD. There are three categories for this. One is called the established risk, and these are children that can be identified through a medical diagnosis. For example, let's say that you have a child that has a delay in language. Let's say he doesn't begin speaking until 3 years of age. So he goes to school at 7. He's lost 2 years of vocabulary, of language experience. Is he going to be frustrated in first grade? Definitely. We also have another category called the biological risk. And these are children with an early medical or health history that could cause the probability of slower development. A premature birth would be an example. I've had a few students that have come through that were preemies, and the ones I've had have struggled academically. It just seems like that somehow has set them back. It's not that they can't learn, but it's just going to take them a little bit more time. And so know something about their medical history that might give you some insight to their struggle. And then we have the third category, the environmental risk. Now, even though these children are at risk for being learning disabled, they are biologically sound. There really is nothing wrong with their brain. There's really nothing wrong with their physical body. But their life experiences have been so limited, and I alluded to that a little bit earlier, that it can actually delay the development. Now, children who are in a situation like this, and I think especially of our people, we have mothers who are so dedicated in being a mother, to be good mothers, but they have sewing to do, they have canning to do, they have a house to keep. Many of them have a fairly large family, and it takes work. It takes lots of work to be a mother. And in their commitment in being a mother, I think sometimes, just like we do sometimes, we forget that even though we're busy, There are things that are more important than our schedule. And I think sometimes, too, mothers have the idea that, well, I'll send them to school and that's where teaching will begin. No, that is not true. And you need to educate your parents. You need to let them know that you need to start working with your children at home at the age of 1, 2, and just right on up. I recall being at the Dairy Queen some years ago, and there was a Mennonite mother in there sitting, waiting for her order. She had her two children there at the table, and she was taking a napkin and folding it into sections. And all of a sudden, I discovered what she was doing. She was teaching, I would guess they were maybe 4 and 5 years old, she was teaching them fractions using her napkin. And she was, do you think that she probably just did it on that day? It was a lifestyle with her. No matter what she was doing, she used that as a teaching opportunity. And when those children came through our school, they were whizzes. I mean, you just knew they had some background. Our school here at FB last year, and also a school in Indiana that I know of, held informative meetings for parents, just telling them the kinds of things they can do with their children at home. I have included in your handout here, I think it's the next to the last page, just ideas you can give to your parents of things that they could work with when their children are at home. And a lot of that is more a concept or a strategy than just actual skills, okay? It's not like if they do number one, they've now attained. It's much bigger than that. So I think we need to inform our parents. Janet Lerner, in her book Learning Disabilities, wrote, "The underlying premise of early childhood special education is that early intervention makes a significant difference in child growth and development. Research has demonstrated quite conclusively that early intervention for children with special needs is beneficial. Many conditions can be alleviated, other problems can be overcome to a large extent, and some problems can be managed so that the child can live a better life." I appreciated, too, what Jonas had to say this morning. I would just totally agree with him that it's so important that the child is ready when he walks into first grade. Another thing you want to take into consideration is their physical aspect. One of the first things I do to parents when I talk to them is I request that if I have a student that is struggling, I ask them, "Have you had your child had his eyes checked?" And most times they'll say yes in third grade, or I'm usually teaching upper elementary. And I say, "Well, why don't you do it again?" And they will. And if it comes back that it's 20/20 vision, I say, "Okay, I'd like to suggest one more thing. I would like for you to consider going to a specialist, and somebody that works with eyes and learning disabilities." And I want to talk about that a little bit more. Let me just include some of the symptoms. If you know they're having, there are some obvious things that come to play when they're having eye problems. They'll complain of headaches. They're the type that will have a headache a couple times a week. They'll squint when they're reading. They want to sit closer to the chalkboard. They'll hold the book very closely to their face. They are the ones that will have a problem with reversals and confused letters. Might make repetitions while they're reading or skip lines while they're reading. They confuse similar words and just seemingly can't sit still. Those are some obvious things that you can see. But if you don't see those things, I still see these things, I would still recommend that the first thing you do is have your parents take the child to an eye doctor. Now, in the last 10 years, and maybe it's been a little bit longer, but I've been aware that there has been a really big study done on vision and the success children have in school. And just this weekend, I came across a couple packets again. A mother shared with me, I had gone to Indiana for 5 weeks. And it was just, I guess God sent. Maria here called me, else I wouldn't have gotten this information. She called me and asked for some information on an eye doctor. So I called this mother, and she was gone for a couple days, and she got back with me. She said, "Oh, Sharon," she said, "I have some more information about vision." And so I made a number of copies of that. And it's just really exciting to see that maybe this is just another really big factor in learning disabilities. I have to think of Mrs. Asanavage. She came to our school just kind of like out of the clear blue sky, just dropped in and said that she works with learning disabled children, but she thinks she's onto something, and it has to do with eyesight. And she gave us a mini seminar on that, and I was just so intrigued, and have been ever since then. I guess that's why I put so much emphasis on the eyes. And she shared a verse, and it made a lot of sense. She took Matthew 6:22-23. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore then eye be single, or if it's clear, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, or in the Greek it has the idea of opaque or diseased, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? And so doesn't that make sense? That if a child has a problem with the eye, it's no wonder that school is a frustration. Well, Dr. Carl Myers, I'm going to refer to his writings in talking about vision. He said it's a complex interaction between the eyes, the brain, and the body. It is so complex, he insists, that 40% of all children have some form of vision problem that will seriously affect classroom performance. What may at first seem to be a question of IQ or motivation may be a vision problem. Now, we're all familiar with the Snellen vision chart, you know, the big E. For example, that only tests visual sharpness at the distance of 20 feet. But what about the clarity at reading and writing distance? Neither does it test for convergence, saccadic eye movements, and visual integration. The point is, there is more to sight than sharpness, and more to vision than sight. He talks about visual gathering. And visual gathering, he says, is the ability to see clearly and singly. Now, all eye doctors routinely test for these two abilities, all right? But there's a third component. He says that gathering is also important. The gathering is important, and it's not tested by most eye doctors. And that's the ability to see comfortably. So take your pen that you have. I want you to do a little experiment. I want you to hold the pen, a couple inches from your nose, and just look at that pen. And just keep looking at that while I talk for a little bit. And if you hold this pen within inches of your nose, you're going to be able to see it clearly and singly, most of you. But for how long? Just keep looking at it, all right? Now, seeing the pen singly and clearly for just a few seconds does not mean that your eyes can work properly and without strain for longer periods. You're doing well. Good job. Keep up. Likewise, a lot of children who look at the tip of their nose cannot maintain clear, single, and comfortable vision at near for more than a few minutes. That is a problem because the children can't. They feel strained, tired, fatigued. When they're reading or they're doing work that is really close, they'll rub their eyes, they'll blink, they'll cover one eye. Are you feeling some tension here? I see some hands moving. Okay, relax. How many of you felt some tension there? I did it when I tried it. It just pulled. Can you imagine what it might be like for a child feeling that all day at school? They're feeling that. So visual processing is the brain's ability to determine and compute the information our eyes gather. Many children will lack good visual processing skills and have trouble computing the gathered information. Vision includes responding. So now that they have gathered this information, they have it in their mind, they also have to somehow make an appropriate response, and often they break down in that as well. So I'm suggesting, to help a child with vision problems, consider finding an optometrist that specializes in helping children with learning disabilities. I will say it probably will be in a larger city, You won't find them in just the small towns where a local optometrist might be located, probably because it's not, they aren't, they're busy, but not all the time, in a smaller area, so they go into the big cities so they can actually handle more people. They work with vision therapy, and the one that I was exposed to in Indiana has a 10-week program, and they insist that the one-on-one therapy is extremely important. When you consider, and this is something that they, a statistic they gave, they said the average child in public education in the United States gets an average of 6.5 hours of one-on-one instruction over 13 years. 6.5 hours in a period of 13 years. Well, this particular center in Indiana provides 50 to 70 hours over within 10 weeks. So if you suspect any vision problems, I would encourage you to encourage parents to arrange for a diagnostic evaluation of the child's visual system. Where do you start? I do have, the last page has some information, and I have the Kendallville, Indiana address on here. I guess it's on this side, down in this, on the bottom of the middle section. And there's a phone number there. He might be able to give you an optometrist in your area. So hopefully you might get some help for this year. But we have sent a couple of our students to specialists in South Bend, and we have seen a marked difference in those students. So I do recommend that. I know I spend a lot of time on this, but I guess I'm just a believer that I think that is a primary culprit in the child that is struggling with learning disabilities. We also have the hearing that you need to be aware of. I remember having one student, and we got him checked out. He was struggling. And here we discover that, I guess there was another teacher that had him before I did. And at that point, they took him to be tested, discovered that he was deaf in the one ear. So once we knew that, we encouraged him to watch our lips, and we also spoke into the side of his ear that he could hear. So he didn't hear well. And that one way you can often detect somebody that has a hearing problem, their voice will be much louder than normal. If you think that one child is just extra noisy, it could be that they have a hearing problem. And there again, you may need to take him to a specialist that is familiar with learning disabilities and can work from that point. Now I'd like to suggest to you some programs you could think about using in your schools, and maybe you already have been using them. But I have found that, or we have found in our school in Indiana, that we've worked with them and have been successful with using these. So I'd like to pass these on to you. The one is simple math and touch math. Now the touch math is basically on the same premise as simple math, but I'll just point that out. The phone number for that is located right under here. I just have a packet. If you're interested in looking at it later, I have a packet you can look through, and if you want to make copies, feel welcome to do so. The idea is to get the child kinesthetically involved in learning his concepts. Now remember, a child with learning disabilities will not learn like most children. So is it okay for them to count on their fingers? Yes, it is. They need to process differently than what you do. Do you want to get them to memorize the facts on their own? Sure you do. But until they do that, let them count. It's not sure it's going to take them longer, but this is how they're processing. This is a very good thing to use. Because it's a multisensory approach using the visual, auditory, and tactile channels of learning, this can be a supplementary math program to complement any math series. So I guess that's why I would recommend it. But you take, you call these balls, you can call them balls or points, but especially for younger ones, your first and second graders, and put the balls, the amount of balls on the number or on the numeral that would connect with them. So we have like two dots for the two, three dots for the three, and then you come on over to the six, and now we run into a problem because we have circles here. And so they make a point along the stick here, and then they have the ball and then a circle around the ball, so you have 6 points there. And notice the same thing happens with seven on this side, and then we have the eight. And then for the nine, you have the six here, but you talk about the face and put three little dots in there. Now, what makes this easy is when they go to add, you would just draw your line and put your plus sign down there, and then they can count the balls, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and they know that their answer is 7. Again, this would just supplement something that you already have. Now, the simple math, this would have to be done on an individual basis. This is not designed for a classroom or a group. This provides the students with an experiential base for learning and internalizing the mathematical operations and concepts to which he is being introduced. At no time in the program is the student expected to memorize by rote repetition. All new information is associated and stored in memory in the student's own filing system of experiences. Associations between the known and unknown provide the students with a mechanism for retrieving specific information and understanding its meaning. So they begin with the concrete. Again, you have your balls here, and then they go another step and add the curves or the lines to these balls, showing them how the balls and these lines represent the same thing. And then you actually teach them that this can stand alone and still mean the same as this. This is teaching them how to write. You would put your hand up to the chalkboard and your thumb up here like this and close your fist. Put an X up here. Then you take your chalk and go around your fist and close off your two. And then you give the two a punch. And that just kind of helps them associate the numeral with the amount here. Associations are really big with simple math and also the Stevenson Learning Program. For example, if I say Italy and ask you what the shape is of that country, no question, right? Tell me, what is it? Boot, of course. But now, tell me, what is the shape of Austria? Okay, we draw a blank on that. And in the same way, this whole program is set up to make associations so that when a child hears something, oh, I have a picture to go with this. I also have the manuals up here, and feel free to look through those later on if you'd like. Then for reading, we have the Stevenson Skills Program that I am most familiar with. This is the one we put Carrie on for 2 years, and it was just amazing the kinds of things she did by the time she had gone through the program. Now, this is an effective alternative approach to reading and writing. The key is learning, again, by association. That's really big. A well-documented technique for enhancing a student's ability to remember information. The program applies this approach to an extensive set of language units, each strategically sequenced to create a solid foundation for mastering English. And she could, by the end of that program, she could pick out verbs and nouns, prepositions. And we started with basics. We started with the letters. Multiple skills, including reading, spelling, comprehension, and more, are coordinated around each language unit. Learning by association differentiates Stevenson from all other approaches to beginning reading. So notice here you have the G for glasses, and of course your S, the snake. Let's say you're working with, and probably Barb could tell me better, or could tell you better, I actually have not taught this. I've just looked at it a lot, and I've had students on this program, or we've had students on this program. But let's say you have the consonant, vowel, vowel, consonant words you're working with. You talk about the peanut butter and jelly sandwich concept, and so the first layer, the first letter, you have the C, and then you put the vowel in that makes the sound, and crunchy peanut butter, you can hear the crunchy peanut butter. And then you put the silent letter in because the jelly doesn't make any sound, and then you finish it up with peanut butter, or with a piece of bread for the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So it's just a really fun program for students that have been so discouraged with reading. And really, you can start this at any level. And even if you have upper elementary or even junior high students starting, tell them, sure, we know you know the stuff, but let's just go through and see if there's anything your brain might not have picked up when you were going through school and learning to read. Spelling. I suggest a lot of kinesthetic activities when you do spelling. Also modify spelling lists. And maybe you need to just drop back two or three grades for them, especially a person that has dyslexia. It is work, and they will struggle. When you do that, remember to document that on the file or in your grade book, so that when you see an A on the file in spelling, you also put down, this child did, let's say this child was in fifth grade and was working at a third grade level, you just put that on file, then you're okay. But we know the A didn't come because he was doing fifth grade work. Just some other things you can do for spelling activities. Have them buy some shaving cream and squirt that on your desk or on their desk and have them spell the word in the shaving cream. Or take some pudding and have them spell, put some wax paper on the desk, tape it down, pour some pudding on there and have them spell the word in pudding. And then, of course, afterwards we eat the pudding. Take Jell-O, sprinkle that on a wax paper and have them spell the words in Jell-O. Just some of those things that reinforce, because they can actually feel, they can see, they might be able to spell it aloud. They should be spelling it to themselves as well. This past year, I became acquainted with Spelling Power. Steve Brubaker introduced me to this, and I'm really excited about this. It's a mother who has written this book because her daughter had gotten into junior high and basically didn't know how to spell. And so she was determined to find answers for her daughter. And she started working with her and started doing research and came up and wrote this whole manual. Now, it's really cumbersome. She does say that you can work with it in the classroom and do it as a group. I tried a little bit last spring, and I haven't quite caught on to how to do it because it's just very, very involved. Remember, this is going to take time. It's not something you can do in 1 year and presto, they know how to spell. It's a program that will involve several years. However, she claims that if you do this and do it as she suggests, they will know how to spell by the time they're through this book. A problem again, you need staff, you need tutors, you need somebody who's going to be committed. Do you have time? Probably not. And so somehow, somewhere, we need to share with parents, share with the school board, and hopefully help them see the vision of the importance of helping students that really are struggling. I believe this book is sold at the bookstore here at the CLR. So you might be able to look at it a little bit more in length and consider this for your school. I would recommend it. The little bit that I have worked with it and I've read in it, I am excited about what I see. So So if I would have, I personally would have a child, I would want to put, and that child would struggle with spelling, I would want to put him on this program. I also have, I'm not going to take the time to go through that, but I have in your packet a handout that says the three R's, remediating, revising, and relating. And I just put down some possible problems you might have in the classroom, like attention problems, listening and comprehension, verbal expression, reading problems, spelling, and so on. And then some ideas on how you can work with them. So now we come to this problem of help. How do we get help? Don't forget your parents. You may have parents out there that are willing to come in an hour every day. Or maybe one year we had some parents that were very willing to help out in first grade. We were overloaded. And like one mother for the whole year came in every Monday. Another mother came in every Tuesday. And one morning didn't matter much to them. But, you know, if they would have had to be there every day, that would have been a difficulty. So maybe if you set up a system, something like that. However, when you work with one student, it's best that they have the same tutor. So maybe you have to suggest to your parents, look, I think I can find a tutor. Would you be willing to pay that person? I worked with a mother. She has three daughters. They were all preemies and majorly struggled. In fact, the two of her daughters, she just kept in the public school because we were not able to give them the help they needed. But her last daughter did come to our school, and that mother is just a perfect example of somebody who really has a vision for her child. She has put hours, literally hours, into that child's life, just working with her on one-on-one. She comes in and says, you know, I really would like to have my student tutored. I would even be willing to pay if you can just find somebody. Well, we did have a part-time person on staff, so I told her, I said, look, would you be willing to share another hour of your time each day and you'll get paid for it? She said, sure, I would. And so that mother, in addition to tuition and everything else they were paying, spent another $25 every week to pay that tutor for an hour of her time. I know parents are strapped financially. You know, they are already making sacrifices by sending them to a Christian school. It takes money. It takes time. But I guess a lot of it is just maybe a matter of our priorities. You know, if we have a student that, or if we have a child that has some deformity, and we know they could be helped by some surgical method, would we do it? Probably. And so maybe if you can make that comparison with a child with learning disabilities and share that with a parent, they might be able to understand where you're coming from, to say, well, you know, there really is something wrong here, and he just needs more time. I see the time is going rather rapidly here. Let me just also mention that you will probably need to tell these students with learning disabilities how to study. You'll have to teach them the study strategies. You might need to work with acronyms and acrostics or anything, any mnemonic that will help them retain, or any association that will help them retain this information. I personally modify quizzes and tests for students with learning disabilities, and I take that from the concept of the talents, you know, how Jesus gave, or how the Jesus told the parable of the man that gave his servants one servant got five talents, the other one two, and the other one. And everyone was expected to work to his ability, but no one was expected to earn more than the amount that he was expected to. And that kind of takes care of the issue of fairness. You know, I hear teachers say, well, is it fair if they don't do all of it? Absolutely. If they're working to their potential, then it is fair. You might have to inform your classroom and talk about it, talk about the differences. Again, it's very important then that you would Make a notation of this in your file for referral purposes. And so what I do, I modify them. I might cut the test a little shorter. I may highlight certain concepts on the test or quiz, just so that will jump out at them. Some students will need to have the test or quiz read to them. They'll do fine if you read it to them. Remember our pen experience, and if they're so focused, there's already some pressure and tenseness coming along because of the test they're taking, and then if they have to focus on something, their eyes just do all kinds of strange things. And so to read it to them may make all the difference. It's not that they don't know the stuff. It's just that they have a hard time reading it. Highlighting just other readings is very helpful. Take learning styles into account if you've done any study on that. If they're auditory, then just give them a lot of auditory things. If they're visual, then you do a lot of demonstrations or illustrations and pictures. Or if they're kinesthetic, get their body involved. And give breaks liberally for these people. Oh, those poor dears. They just work so hard and sometimes are just so frustrated. And you can tell when they start fidgeting. Sometimes I'll just go over to a student and say, okay, I know you've been working hard. Why don't you go run around the gym or around the schoolyard for 5 minutes or whatever and come back and then you can work again. Or sometimes if they're hitting the point of just desperation and frustration, I'll do the same thing. And you know, it really does make a difference. They'll come back in and they're ready to hit it again. Your attitude really does make a difference. And in conclusion, I just like to remind us that we're all created with a certain amount of limitations. Some with more than others. But I think, and I'm coming back to what I said at the beginning, I think the largest factors in success when working with students that are struggling academically is to show them genuine love and encouragement. Now, love bears all things. That includes the negative responses students make to us. It believes all things. That each child has been designed with purpose. It hopes all things. The next time, maybe the student can get a higher percentage. It endures all things, accusations that may come. Would some of the Bible stories have ended differently had the people with limitations not received encouragement? Think about Moses with his speech impediment and the voice of the Lord saying, I'll be your mouth. Who made your mouth? Or Ruth with a cultural barrier and Boaz blessing her. Lame Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, was blessed by eating at David's table continually. The paralytic man that was told to take up his bed and walk. That's encouragement. I'm going to close with a poem. The title is Not in 100 Years. In fourth grade, one boy, Milton, couldn't read. Gawky, tall, and thin. When it was his turn, he would stand, fumble with a word or two, then sit down again. Hopeless. But one day, a few words came, then a few more. Our teacher moved near. Yes, yes, that's right. You can read it. Go on, Milton. He went on, stumbling, but words came. Of course, keep on going, Milton. I knew you could. And now the next word. The next word starts with, just like your name. Yes, yes, go on. Good. Every one of us sat listening, watching, as Miss Baldwin pushed words out of Milton, prompting, urging. She waved her arms. Her voice rose and rose. And suddenly, I sat glued to my desk, amazed, seeing what I had never dreamed to see, not in 100 years. Great tears in my teacher's eyes. God bless you as you begin a year teaching these special students.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.